Hello, kiddies. I'm Alice Cooper, and I'm on Sydney Taylor's podcast. And you better be listening, because I know where you live.
You've tuned in to the most crazy, rocking metal podcast on the air. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Metal from the Inside.
What is going on, everybody? I'm your host, Sydney Taylor, and you are listening to the Metal from the Inside podcast. Thank you guys so much for tuning into another episode and joining me for another week. You are listening to episode 39 of the podcast, and if you've already seen who my guest is this week and have read the title of this episode, you would know just how over the moon I am for my guest this week and for this episode, episode 39 of the Metal from the Inside podcast. This week, I am so honored to bring you guys a brand new interview with a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, a hard rock legend, a shock rock legend, an innovator, a game changer, and my biggest hero, Mr. Alice Cooper. And I can't believe that I'm even saying that in an introduction to an episode. I'm really just, I don't even know really where to start on how much this conversation means to me. It's just a huge full circle moment. And I've had a couple of those on the podcast, you know, back when I spoke to Jolynn Turner and, you know, even getting to speak with David Ellefson. Every time I get to, it's so incredible, you know. But every single time that I get to talk to somebody like Jolynn Turner or David Ellefson, and now an Alice Cooper, which I feel like Alice Cooper is just such a huge part of me. It's such a big part of my identity, and it feels like who I am when I think of my interests and my career and growing up and just being Sydney Taylor. That's just, Alice Cooper is a huge part of that. So, you know, I think back when I have these incredible artists on my podcast, you know, of all the times of listening to their music and feeling so much passion for the music and the art that these people have created. And so getting to sit down and have a conversation with them, you know, I'm always professional and I'm always professional first. But, you know, deep down when I get off of some of these calls, I kind of have to sit there for a minute and pinch myself a little bit and go, man, like I'm talking to the people that have inspired me in ways that I can't even express to you guys in a sentence. It's just incredible. And to have Alice on the podcast this week, it's just, if I could go back and tell that 10-year-old girl who was listening to all of those Alice Cooper songs and was holding on to the set of beads that her dad brought home from an Alice Cooper show and gave her, that a decade later, she would be sitting down for an interview with him, I don't know if she'd believe me, but Alice and I sat down and we had such a wonderful conversation about everything that Alice has been up to over the course of the last year. I know that we've gotten pretty familiar with that topic on a lot of these episodes when we talk to various artists. You know, everyone's been home. So we talk a little bit about what Alice has been up to over the course of the last year while he has been home from touring. And we also discuss the brand new Alice Cooper record, Detroit Stories, which came out back in February of this year and actually hit number one on the charts. So we talk about the brand new record and of course the history behind Detroit and Alice Cooper, which if you know the Alice Cooper story, you know they're tied to Detroit, Michigan, and of course Alice's personal ties to that area. So, and on top of discussing everything that Alice has been up to recently, we also jump into some Alice Cooper history and discuss the 50th anniversary of the band's third studio record, the original Alice Cooper Group's third studio record, Love It to Death, which just celebrated its 50th anniversary about a month back, which is insane. And we talk a little bit about what it was like writing that record and, of course, working on that record with Bob Ezrin and just how it's been 50 years and how Alice feels looking back on that time. So we touch on that and we also discuss my favorite Alice Cooper record of all time, which I've talked about here on the podcast as well as on Sea of Tranquility and pretty much every podcaster show show that I've guested on. We talk about my favorite Alice Cooper record and my favorite record of all time, From the Inside, which was released in 1978. And Alice worked with the legendary lyricist Bernie Taupin on that record. Alice discusses the overall process in writing and recording that record and what it was like getting some of the guest musicians that he had on that album. He had quite a bit of them, people from Toto and Elton John's band, of course, with that Bernie Taupin tie and everything like that. So if you love that album just as much as me, be sure to stick around to the end of the interview because that's when we discuss it. But it was so cool to hear him talk about that album because that album has been so important to me in not only just loving it so much, but being a huge inspiration to just me and my career and everything like that. So I absolutely love that album. I love it to death. Pun intended, but it was so great to hear Alice talk about that record. And we also discussed my favorite Alice Cooper song of all time, How You Gonna See Me Now, which is the ballad on From the Inside. So we talked a little bit about the story behind that song, and it was just so cool. So if you love that record, be sure to stick around to the end of the interview. And we talk about so much in this interview. We cover Alice Cooper history, as well as even Alice Cooper's image in the media, and a bunch of different stuff we talk about in this interview. So it was such a blast. And I mean, I got to sit down on a Monday night and talk to my hero. So that marks a good night in my book. So I really hope that you guys enjoy this week's episode. Without further ado, when we get back from this very short break, we're going to get into my favorite podcast episode of all time with my favorite guy of all time, Mr. Alice Cooper. Welcome back, everybody, to the Metal from the Inside podcast. I'm your host, Sydney Taylor, and this week's guest needs no introduction. He's the legendary Alice Cooper, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, and one of my heroes. Thank you so much, Alice, for taking the time to come on the podcast this week.
Thank you, and I still have our friendship bracelet.
Yeah, that's a fun story. People, I've told it on the podcast before. Like I just told you back when I was 15. So it's crazy. And I love that you still have that. It's so great. But we were kind of just talking before we got on about, you know, the craziness of this last year and, you know, how you had to get out of, you know, Germany right at the last second when COVID started. So, you know, it's kind of a loaded question, but I like to ask it at the beginning just because it's important to check in on each other. But how has the last year been for you? Because I mean, you've been in the industry for 50 years and you've toured for pretty much 50 years.
Yes.
So, no, I mean, no. You don't have a lot of time home normally. So what has this been like for you?
Well, the good thing about it is that even when I go on tour, Cheryl's in the show. So, I mean, you know, when I leave home, I don't really leave home. I bring home with me. But I do have to leave the kids and the grandkids and all that, you know, and yeah, I'm on the road 2/3 of the year, at least. When we had to cancel, we had to cancel 180 cities, 17 countries. You know, and that's between my band and the Hollywood Vampires,
right?
You know, with Johnny and Joe. And so that was another 30 or 40 shows we had to cancel. But I'm looking on the horizon and I'm seeing all those shows being rebooked right now. So, you know, we're going to be back out there probably end of summer, I would say. You know, that's what it looks like. But, you know, being home was, you know, maybe I needed to take a year off. But we recorded an album. We recorded Detroit Stories. And it debuted at number one, which is something every 48 years I try to get a number one album, you know.
Yeah, which, I mean, I was going to say, you've stayed busy. I mean, you're always busy when you're touring regardless. You have the radio show, you're always working on music, you're doing a million things at once. But, I mean, especially with this album, and I know you're already kind of in the talks of recording the next album, you know, you always kind of stay busy. So, you know, it's good to hear that something good came out of it because we got this album.
Well, I just got back from Nashville. Bob and I started working on the next album. And, you know, you're going to get an avalanche of records coming in this year, only because all of the musicians that I know, that I talk to, if you can't tour, you're going to record. You're going to write songs and record. So there's going to be a tsunami of albums coming out. You know, I mean, they're all probably already done and ready to go. So, I mean, it's going to be like concerts too. When we go back out, everybody's going to be on tour. There's going to be a concert every night somewhere, you know, which is great. I think it's going to be bigger than ever. People always say, Well, it'll never be the same. And I said, why would you wear a mask if you've been inoculated and everybody there has been inoculated and there's no more disease? Why would it be different? You know, it should be bigger than it ever was, not smaller.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I say this a lot just in this past year of, you know, when I went to my last show, I am not even going to lie. It's, you know, I was so used to going to shows and, you know, when you're doing something like that, you take it for granted because it's, you know, it's just kind of what you do. You go to concerts, you play a show, you know, it's just how your life has gone and what you've always done. And then, you know, it's kind of taken away from you for a little bit. And I think that when shows do come back, you know, it's going to be something that people enjoy, kind of like you said, like 10 times more, because, you know, we're not going to be taking it for granted as much anymore. You know, we've had to live without them for a year.
Yeah. Oh, no, I think people are starving for live entertainment anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did a thing the other night for a Solid Rock. I have this charity called Solid Rock that any teenager can come in and learn any instrument and all that. But we fund it by a golf tournament and at Christmas, the Christmas pudding, which all involves me inviting whoever shows up. And the band was, we did an outdoor show at night in Arizona, which was nice, about 1,000 people. Everybody was in their own place, you know. You know, I had Tommy from Kiss on guitar. And Chuck Eric on bass and Fitz on drum. Everybody was from a different band. Damon Johnson, you know, from Thin Lizzy on guitar. So, and let me see, the guys from Asia showed up, and Lou Graham from Foreigner. And I mean, it was on and on. My son's band was there, and it was such a great night. It was about 80 degrees, and it was just fun to get up on stage and play anything. We were doing everybody else's music and some of ours, but, you know, did a lot of covers and everybody had a great time. So, I mean, I could just tell by the feel of that audience that it was like a relief that there was live music again.
Yeah. It's seeing that, like you kind of said, with the shows that are starting to get booked and announced, and it's kind of like we're finally seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, and, you know, the vaccine's rolling out even better. So I completely agree. I think when it comes back, it's going to be better than ever.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about the 50th anniversary of this album, which is one of my favorites. And it's been 50 years since this album came out this year. And I mean, of course, every Alice Cooper fan knows it. You know, it has I'm 18, it has Ballad of Dwight Frye, it has all those kind of classics. But it has some songs that often go under the radar that I love, you know, Caught in a Dream, Long Way to Go, all of those songs. So, you know, how does it feel for you to kind of reflect on this album? You know, you're 50 years out from it. You're still working, you're still touring, you're in two bands. You know, what does it feel like to think back on that time and, you know, writing and recording that record?
It's so funny. People, I think that I'm nostalgic, and I am to a point. You know, of course, I look back at those days and go, those were the greatest days. They were so much fun because you were creating and it was getting accepted for once. You know, for once we were getting played on the radio. I mean, we never thought we'd ever get played on the radio until Bob Ezrin came along and with this album, with Love It to Death. I think Bob gave us an identity with that album. Before that, Pretty's for You and Easy Action really were not Alice Cooper albums. They were all written when we were the Nas or we were the Spiders. All those songs were. And so Love It to Death came along and Bob literally just, we kept working on the music until it sounded like Alice Cooper. Like when you hear a Doors song, you know it's the Doors. When you hear, you know, the Rolling Stones, you know it's the Stones. We didn't have that identity. We had all the notoriety, you know, I mean, everybody knew about the show and everybody knew about Alice and everything. But if you played an Alice Cooper song, it could have been anybody. Bob came along and really pinpointed the voice, the bass, the guitar sound, the drum sound to when you heard Love It to Death, you went, oh, that's Alice Cooper. You know, that's why I consider that the first Alice Cooper album. And we still do, you know, we still do Dwight Frye. We still do. We do A Long Way to Go every once in a while. We do 18, of course. That was the big hit, you know.
Yeah.
And at the time, we were in Detroit with the Stooges and the MC5 and, you know, Bob Seger and Ted Nugent and Susie Quattro. I mean, it was the greatest rock scene in America was Detroit at that time.
Yeah, and I love that whole story of you guys recording that record. You recorded it in that farmhouse and, you know, lots, you know, what's happening there with Bob. And I love that you said that you kind of consider it the first Alice Cooper record, because I've always felt that way as well. You know, it's not the debut, but it has always felt like the debut to me when it comes to the sound and everything like that. And yeah, I mean, again, the story I always think of when I think of Bob Ezrin producing that is the story of, you know, he thought it said, "I'm edgy," and he heard you go on the, you know, the 10 minute long jam. And he's like, "We need to turn that into something." And he was right. But, you know, that's the whole Alice Cooper band. You know, you have Dennis, Glenn, Michael, Neil. And so it's been, you know, 50 years since then. And something that I thought I would share with you, which is so great, because I spoke to Dennis, he was on the podcast not too long ago, and he showed me this great letter that he kept from you from like 1966 that he said that you sent him when he was working on his grandfather's farm
in Oregon.
Oregon, and you sent him a letter. He said he just found it, and you were asking him, or you were telling him what Beatles songs you guys should cover next when he got back home. And yeah. I thought that was so great, because it's, you know, it's incredible to see kind of that transition that you guys had from, you know, being the Spiders and the Earwigs, and, you know, eventually going to this record.
Well, everybody started as a, you know, as a cover band. The Beatles started as a cover band. The Rolling Stones did. They didn't do any of their own material at first, hardly anything on the first two albums. But so back then, we were still in high school. I was like a senior in high school, and I think he just graduated. And we had just put the band together. And he spent the whole summer learning bass. You know, John Spear spent the summer drumming. Everybody, we didn't really get together till school started again. And by that time, everybody could play. Glenn Buxton was already a good player, you know. And then we could actually get into rehearsal and do five or six new Beatles songs or Rolling Stones songs or Yardbirds and stuff. We graduated into the Yardbirds because that was a little more complicated.
Yeah.
Over Who, you know. But I mean, every single band started out as a covers band. And that's actually how the Vampires, you know, when I did the movie with Johnny Depp, Dark Shadows, and I was telling him about the drinking club, the Hollywood Vampires, with Harry Nilsson and John Lennon and everybody. We drank every night, and they called us the Hollywood Vampires because we drank all night, and nobody ever saw us during the day. That's what a vampire does. Right? And he said, "Well, what if we put a band together and just did songs for all of our dead drunk friends? You know, all the guys that died as the Vampires." And I went, "That's a great idea." And Joe Perry was there. He said, "I'm in." Duff McKagan, "I'm in." Da da da. And pretty soon that band was born. And it was basically, now we're doing our own stuff, but I still always like to think of us as the world's most expensive bar band.
And it must be fun for you. And I ask this a lot, you know, the people who do covers and the artists who do covers. It must be fun for you to sometimes play songs that you grew up loving, you know, like a Yardbird song. You know, you obviously have to play the songs when you're performing live that are yours and have been, you know, known as Alice Cooper classics. But sometimes it must be nice to kind of get out of that element and go back to what really got you like invigorated to do this.
Well, the funny thing is that when I play Alice, when in the Alice Cooper show, I never talk to the audience. Alice, I want Alice to be unworldly. I don't want him to relate to the audience. I want them to look at him as some arrogant villain, you know, condescending sort of, you know, really scary character. But at the same time, when I'm with the Vampires, I'm the lead singer in the Vampires. I'm not really the Alice Cooper that they see from Alice Cooper. So I talk to the audience all night, like I used to when I was in a bar band. And I'll tell them stories about the Doors, and I'll tell them stories about, you know, and then we'll do a Doors song, and I'll tell them a story about Keith Moon, and we'll do a Who song. And it's, for me, it's a little bit of a relief that I even play guitar on two songs, and Johnny sings two songs, and Joe sings a couple, and I literally play guitar on them. So, you know, it's a real departure for me to be in the Vampires. Because it's not the same kind of pressure it is to be. And when you're an Alice Cooper show, you better know where everything is going. You better be in the right place at the right time, or something, you'll get killed. I always tell the band I told Nita this. I said, "Nita, I can guarantee you three things. You're going to get paid. You're going to see the world. You're going to get stitches." Everybody in that band has had stitches.
I mean, it's bound to happen, right? When there's a guillotine involved.
Well, there's a guillotine, but I mean, you know, I got switchblades, I've got swords, I've got everything up there. And I'm a little bit freewheeling. I don't necessarily look to where everybody is. And every once in a while, they walk a little bit close and get nicked. you know, and those are not rubber swords.
No, they're real. Yeah. Yeah, no, like you said, it must be cool for you guys to get out and do that in the Hollywood Vampires thing. And, you know, that's spawned a whole other band and a whole other kind of side gig for you that you've been doing for a couple of years now. So is there anything in the works for that album wise? Because I know that, you know, of course you have your career, Joe is Aerosmith, Johnny has his films, you know, is there anything that you guys have worked on over the course of the last year?
They've all been writing. Everybody's been writing. I got in touch with Johnny the other day and he says, I've been writing. And I said, good, good, good. Joe's writing. I'm writing. So when we get together, we'll have a ton of material to go through. And Tommy is a big element in that. Tommy Henriksen's a big element. And of course, you know, whoever's going to produce it. You know, Tommy produced the last album, the Rise album. But Ezrin produced the first one. And so it's a matter of who's going to produce and, you know, pick the best songs. We've been together 7 years. So there's never been one argument in that band. There's never been one person ever raising their voice to anybody else in that band, which is the best way to tour, the best way to record. You're with your best friends and nobody's an ego trip, and which is great, you know. And the same thing with my band, my tour band. Nobody ever argues in our band, you know, Ryan and Nita and everybody, Glenn, everybody's good friends.
Yeah, which is how it should be, right? I mean, you're also too at that point in your career where you can, you know, pick and choose people who are positive, you know, minded and have a good work ethic and all that fun stuff. So, I mean, you at this point have earned, you know, having a stress-free work environment.
Yeah. I've been in bands where it's been like, where I couldn't wait for the tour to be over.
Yeah.
You know, and it was because I had hired two or three wrong people. They were great players, but they just were, you know, constant chaos.
Yeah.
You know, and I just, you don't need that on the road. It's hard enough to get out there and tour every night for, you know, 180 times, let alone deal with that. You know, so I always made sure after that everybody got that was picked was people that were best friends. So, you know, on nights off, everybody's going to the movies together. Everybody's going to the bars together. Everybody's doing this, you know, and that's what it should be.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that you right now have a fantastic lineup. I love everybody in your band so much. It's probably my favorite lineup that you've had. And, you know, since it started, since Nita came in, which I've loved every lineup since then, but I think that there's just kind of a magic that's happening here with this band
is like that. They're so tight. They can't wait to get on stage. And they understand that, you know, I said, when you get on stage, I want you to reek of ego. I want you to be a rock star. I want you to be up there bigger than life. And you own that stage. I want that. I want the audience to feel that. Off stage, I want just the opposite. I said, if I don't have an ego problem, nobody here should have an ego problem.
Right.
I said, so we are off stage. You sign everything. You take pictures. You're nice. You're happy and everything. And everybody is that anyways. I don't have to tell them that. They're that.
And kind of touching, going back to kind of Alice, you know, as the character, you know, something that I've heard you say many times before is, you know, Alice kind of has always been this, you know, icon and somebody that's kind of always represented the outcasts. You know, it's been that way, you know, since you guys, you know, came out, and it's, you know, stayed that way for people who are my age who, you know, don't conform exactly to, you know, mainstream popularity and to the societal, you know, norms per se. So, I mean, when you were growing up, I mean, I know that you, of course, had a friend group and you were, an artist and all this fun stuff. Did you ever really feel kind of like an outcast? And if you did, you know, how did it feel to kind of become an icon and someone who kind of represented, you know, that part of the youth?
Well, the outcast thing didn't really come till we got into rock and roll. We were more of a rock and roll outcast. I was Ferris Bueller in high school. I mean, I was like, I ran the school, basically. I had people doing my homework. You know, it was so easy. I was just Mr. Personality. I made everybody laugh. Boom, 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 you know. And so I kind of ran. I got myself through high school totally as a con man. and then when the band started, we realized that our band did not conform with other rock bands. We had this thing that kept us away from being in the center We were the outskirts. And then I started realizing that's who our audience was the cast, the outcasts. And I said, well, we're an outcast and that's an outcast. So we moved to Detroit, realized that Detroit's an outcast city. I mean, you know, all the butt of the jokes are Detroit. And yet it's the hard rock capital of America. So look at all the outcasts that live in Detroit. I mean, look at the Iggy and the Stooges, the MC5. Everybody that came out of Detroit was some kind of rebel, you know, and that's what we where we feel felt comfortable. But after when we moved out of Detroit, we didn't fit in New York. We didn't fit in L.A. We were the outcast band until we had hit records. Then all of a sudden, we were the it band. Yeah. Now everybody was looking at us and we had to maintain our sort of personality. And we realized that we never bent to the charts. The charts had to bend to us. And when you have a number one record, then everybody looks at you in the business, certainly the business guys, and goes, wait a minute, we need a band like Alice Cooper now in our record company. You know, because you became, if you have a hit record, you have the Willy Wonka golden ticket then, because yeah. you're making money for everybody. And that is what all they understand, the suits, is that you're making money. They don't care about the fact that you know, 2 weeks ago, they wouldn't touch you with a 10-foot pole. All of a sudden, you're the thing now, and everybody has to, you know, adhere to you. So I'm very proud in the fact that we never bent to the charts. The charts bent to us.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same people who walked out in the whiskey when everybody turned away. We're front row at the Hollywood Bowl, right?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. Because then it became, they kind of looked around and said, wait a minute, who are we supposed to like now? Oh, yeah, we like Alice now. Yeah.
It's so interesting too. I mean, ever since you guys came out, you know, there's always just been the stigma. And I think it's crazy because you guys were kind of right at the cusp, you know, with the Black Sabbath and kind of this beginning of the hard rock and what would go on to be heavy metal. You know, you guys were always pegged as being evil and quote unquote, you know, being satanic and all of these kind of these stereotypes. And I wanted to ask you about this because I saw an article today. Something about, you know, like a hard rock radio station being like protested because, you know, rock is satanic. And I just think it's crazy. You know, do you find it kind of insane that 50 years after you were being called evil and kind of being banned from countries and all this stuff that, you know, that's kind of still sometimes a stigma that has kind of revolved around this type of music?
I think by now people understand that Alice is, you know, a character, you know, I'm Captain Hook, you know, and they understand also, I've been very vocal about the fact that I'm Christian. You know, I go to Bible study on Wednesday mornings and there's nothing satanic at all in my show. There is horror in the show because I think that that's funny in some places, you know, if you make fun of things that you're not supposed to make fun of, you're suddenly satanic, you know. But back then I could see why they would put that moniker on us because there was no way of comparing us to anything. So the closest thing they could come to was, oh, there's a snake in the show and he gets his head cut off. And it's, instead of them thinking, oh, it's like a, you know, it's like a horror movie, it was all of a sudden became satanic,
right?
Which it never in the least bit. If I thought that it was satanic, I would retire because that's the last thing I would want to be thought of is that. If you want satanic, politics is satanic because what do rock and rollers want? They want to play music. They want to act it out on stage. The money is great. The girls are great. Okay. Great. What does politicians want? Power. That's where satanic comes in because you musicians don't want power.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's party all night long, kiss kind of thing, you know, and we want to create. We're artists. I mean, I have more Christian songs in my set than I have anything dark. I mean, if you really think of it, you know, there are songs that are very, very Christian based. But nobody will ever see that. They'll see it as the ones that want to see it as dark. They'll see it as dark. But a lot of my songs are actually warning against that.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where, you know, kind of growing up and when I was getting into Alice Cooper and you know, and all that fun stuff. It's, you know, I always saw kind of the soft side of Alice. You know, I have always thought that you are such a great kind of like ballad writer, and you're so kind of, you know, great at these kind of slower songs, which I feel like, you know, I love the hard rock and stuff too. And so does, you know, other fans, but you know, you have some great ballads and kind of great love songs that I feel like a lot of people, you know, sometimes don't think about when they think of Alice Cooper. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, you know, when you're writing, do you find that, you know, you kind of have an easier time writing ballads and things like that? Or do you just enjoy them? Because I feel like they're some of your most standout songs, at least in my opinion.
Ballads are easier to write than hard rock songs. Especially when I was working with Dick Wagner. Dick Wagner and I wrote four ballads in a row that were hits, you know, and it, for some reason we clicked with that. Only Women Bleed and You and Me, I Never Cry, How Are You Gonna See Me Now? And we wrote five or six, or my favorite, in fact, I think maybe my favorite song, two of my favorite songs I ever wrote was I Am Made of You and Might As Well Be on Mars are two of the best songs I think I've ever written.
Yeah.
To me, it's easier to write that than it is to write Under My Wheels, you know, because there's only so many chords. There's only so many words where you don't, it's easy to sound like somebody else during a hard rock song. Whereas a ballad, you could put a lot more heart, a lot more emotion into it. And you can, you know, you can make it a much more individual song. Almost all those songs were written about Cheryl. And we've been married 45 years, you know.
Yeah.
And so it was easy to write those songs because I had a great, you know, somebody to write it about.
Yeah, I was going to bring up Might As Well Be on Mars because I know that that's one of my favorite Alice Cooper songs. And it's really, it's funny talking to other diehard fans. Like I talk to Don Jameson all the time. He's one of my good friends and he's very, you know, into the old Alice catalog. And I mean, we talk about some of those kind of underrated songs all the time, and Might As Well Be on Mars always comes up. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's one of your longest songs and it's kind of hard to fit into a set and, you know, to kind of to play it live. But to me, that's one of your most, I totally agree, it's one of your most standout tracks.
Well, when you write something that's, you know, is not going to be a stage song, it's not going to be a stage song, but it's going to be a great album cut. And it probably is not going to be, you know, one that even gets played on the radio.
Yeah.
But that song was written, and when we got done writing that song, we looked at each other and went, wow, that's really it. That's, we can't do anything else to that song. That is just exactly what it should be. Something to Remember Me By was another song that Dick Wagner and I wrote that was just such a heartbreaker, you know, but it was great. I mean, you knew when you finished it, it was what it was supposed to be. Simplicity is hard in rock. It's easy to write Halo of Flies. It's much harder to write I Never Cry because one is so simple and the other one is complicated. The complicated one's easy. Writing a Beatles song is the hardest thing in the world, you know, because it's so simple.
Right. And one album I really wanted to talk to you before I let you go to was my personal favorite Alice Cooper album. And it's, again, talking about diehard fans. It's kind of one that I feel like all of us collectively kind of feel this way about. And that is From the Inside, which I have behind me.
I knew you were going to say that.
It's one of those just, it's, you know, to me, one of your most musical, orchestral, you know, lyrical albums that you've ever done. And, you know, to this day was different from everything that you had done before and is still kind of different than everything that you've done since. So do you have any memories of putting that record together? And, you know, did you think that it would ever, you know, be such a, I don't know, a mainstay in a fan's, you know, collection?
Well, I had just come out of the hospital.
Yeah.
And Bernie Taupin was my best friend. And so Bernie and I said, as a lyricist, Bernie, I'm gonna tell you about all the characters I met in this insane asylum. It wasn't an insane asylum. It was a place to get better from alcohol. But I was the only one in there for alcohol. Everybody else was in there for like really crazy reasons. They were all super rich people that were in this hospital. They were truly insane. I mean, I was the only one that was actually there for alcohol. So when I got out, I said, Bernie, we sat down and wrote the album. It's just from the characters, for Veronica's sake you know, Jackknife Johnny. All these characters were real people in there. Millie and Billy. And Bob Ezrin was working on, I think, Pink Floyd or somebody at the time. So I decided to, David Foster got involved. David Foster loved what we were doing, loved the idea. Basically, the band on that was Toto.
Yeah, Steve Lukather played it on, right? Yeah.
Well, Lukather and the Picaro brothers were all the backup band. They were, you know, and then, of course, I had Davey Johnstone on it. I had Lukather, like I said, a bunch of people were coming in because they were all, I had Maurice White from Earth, Wind & Fire. The only duet he ever did in his life was Quiet Room. He had never done a duet with anybody, and he said he never wanted to do a duet, but he loved that song, and he says, well, Alice and I will do this song. And so that was the only duet Maurice White ever did. And I think that may be the best musical album we ever did.
Yeah, everything I completely agree.
Flo and Eddie did all the background singing on it. And it was so varied. I you know, the very first song, From the Inside, was basically a dum, 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 dum. You know, and the show went right along with it with the dancing bottles and all this stuff, you know. But it was the most musical album. And David Foster, one time in an interview, he'd done everything from Whitney Houston to everybody you could think of. And he says, the most fun I ever had doing an album was From the Inside with Alice, because it was so creative. We allowed everyone to be creative in the whole thing. And it ended up just being a little gem of an album.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I love the show that goes along with that. You know, you did the DVD with that and the video and the big car that came out during
Cheryl was born in Beverly Hills, and she had a dancing scotch bottle. And, you know, I mean, it was really, the show was so much fun to work with. The show was just, that show was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I completely agree. And one little request is, I hope one day you sneak in How You Gonna See Me Now, because that's my favorite Alice Cooper song of all time. So one day, sneak that in there.
The truth in that song was this. I had been married to Cheryl for 5 years. No, I was never drunk. I was never falling down drunk. I was never abusive. I was always funny. And that was the problem. It was that nobody saw the problem. And so when I went into the hospital, I thought for myself, wait a minute, I'm going to come out of here sober. What if she doesn't love the sober version of me? And that's where the song was born, right there. You know, you're sitting at home and I'm going to come home sober. And what if we don't click?
Yeah.
You know, and that was the heart of it. Of course, I knew that wasn't the truth, but it was a great romantic thought, and it turned into a song. And it was honestly, I think, one of the three best songs we've ever written.
Oh, I completely agree. And I think, you know, it's the fact that it was also so personal. When things are personal like that, it adds so much to a track and to a song. So
yeah, there's a real story behind it. Yeah.
Yeah, it meant something to you when you're writing it. So thank you so much, Alice, for taking the time to sit down and speak with me today. It was such an honor to have you on. And it meant a lot. Thank you so much.
Well, I'll see you backstage. You know, whenever we're in town, you have got the golden backstage pass. So come back and say hi.
I absolutely will. Thank you so much.
You guys just finished listening to my interview with the one and only, the legendary, Alice Cooper. Thank you guys so much for taking the time to listen to this week's episode, and I hope you guys enjoyed listening to the conversation as much as I enjoyed being a part of it. To be quite transparent, I tried recording this introduction and this outro to the episode at least 10 times now, and I'm just having a hard time properly conveying how much I am so thankful for this interview and for this episode and to have this opportunity. I can't actually say or find the right words to say it properly. So it's I don't know. I'm just fumbling because I don't even know what to say to properly express my gratitude. And you guys are just listening to this happening in real time. I'm at a loss for words, truly. And that's not a good thing as a podcaster. I should not be lost for words, but right now I am am completely lost for words. So thank you guys for taking the time to listen to this week's episode. If you loved what you heard and you were interested in donating to the Metal from the Inside podcast, you can go to www.anchor.fm/metalfromtheinside. Here you can click on the support button and donate either $1, $5, or $10 a month directly to the podcast. Every single dollar that I receive goes directly back into the Metal from the Inside podcast so I can continue to create even better content for you guys. You can also support the podcast by purchasing Metal from the Inside merchandise, which you can find at www.season-of-mist.com. Go ahead and type Metal from the Inside in the search bar, and there you will see our Metal from the Inside flame logo design, where you can purchase a t-shirt, a hoodie, a long sleeve, a woman's cut shirt, a cropped hoodie, a zip up, anything that your heart desires. You can go ahead and purchase our Metal from the Inside flame logo on. So that is another way to donate to the podcast. And like I always mention, a donation is by no means necessary. I always like to have the option there for those that might be interested. The podcast is available for 100% free on every streaming platform, from Spotify to Apple, Amazon, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Anchor, which is our host site, and pretty much anywhere that you get your podcasts. Like I mentioned in the introduction, we are also on YouTube. So if you would like to watch the Zoom interviews and watch the interviews instead of just listen to them, that is the place to do so. We are on YouTube at Metal from the Inside. So just be sure to type Metal from the Inside in the YouTube search bar and we should be the very first hit. If you would like to stay up to date with the Metal from the Inside podcast, the best place to do so is at our website, which is www.metalfromtheinside.com. We're also on Instagram at Metal from the Inside, on Twitter at MFTI Official, and we also have our official Facebook page of the same name. If you'd like to stay up to date with me, Sydney Taylor, in real time, the best place to do so is on Instagram at Sydney Anna Taylor and on Twitter at S Taylor Official. You guys can reach out to me anytime, ask me questions, or if you just want to talk about some rock and metal, those are the best places to reach me. Once again, thank you guys so much from the bottom of my heart for all of the support, especially on this episode. Right now, when I am recording this introduction and outro, I had posted the promo for tomorrow, which is when you're listening to this, not too long ago, and I've gotten so much support so far, and it means so much. I've had so many people tell me how happy they are for me because they know that this is such a huge deal and that this conversation was such a huge deal for me, which it is, and I've only said that about 18 million times in the last hour, but I really, really appreciate everyone's kind words and support, and not only just for your support, but for also listening, because like I mentioned, the podcast would be nothing without you guys listening and being so supportive. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Stick around. 1 week from today, we will be back with a brand new episode of the Metal from the Inside podcast, which will be episode 40, which is insane. We will be back right here next week for a brand new interview and episode 40 of the Metal from the Inside podcast. I'm your host, Sydney Taylor. See you guys soon. Stay safe and rock on.